If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, starvation and famine in Gaza. A UN expert speaks out.
2.3 million people have pushed into hunger at a speed we've never seen before. We've never seen a civilian population made to go hungry so completely and so quickly. Never in modern history. We've never seen children pushed into malnutrition so quickly. Never.
And a group of Canadian lawyers demand that the Trudeau government stop supporting Israeli genocide.
We can't leave any stone unturned. We have an obligation to pursue all avenues of lawful relief for the Palestinian people. And if the Attorney General of Canada is absolutely determined to cast those legal provisions by the wayside, despite the evidence of genocide, then it's incumbent upon us as citizens of conscience to pursue all avenues of relief.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Seven months into Israel's assault on Gaza, starvation in the besieged enclave is widespread. In North Gaza, famine is projected and imminent. These are the latest findings of a UN-affiliated group of food security experts released on March 18th. The Famine Review Committee based itself on something called the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC system. According to IPC metrics, famine has begun when at least 20% of households face an extreme lack of food, at least 30% of children suffer from acute malnutrition, and 2 out of 10,000 are dying each day from starvation or from the interaction of malnutrition and disease. The famine threshold for acute food insecurity has already been far exceeded in Gaza, accompanied by major acceleration of death and malnutrition, the committee declared. 55% of North Gaza households are currently experiencing catastrophic food insecurity, it said, a figure projected to rise to 70% by mid-July. According to Al Jazeera, 27 Gazans have died of hunger since Israel's assault began, 23 of them children. On a related matter, this past week, the Irish government announced that it will be intervening in South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, and that it'll be calling on the UN's top court to include forced starvation in its definition of genocide. The GPM spoke about all this with Michael Fakhry, special UN rapporteur on the right to food. In a March 5th statement, Fakhry and five other UN experts declared that Israel has been intentionally starving Gaza. Michael Fakhry is a professor at the University of Oregon School of Law. In your March 5th news release as a special rapporteur, along with a host of other special rapporteurs following the February 29th flower massacre in Gaza, you write, Israel has been intentionally starving the Palestinian people. What evidence do you have that Israeli authorities, the military, are actually intentionally starving?
They said it themselves. On October 8th, the Minister of Defense of Israel announced a total siege against Gaza. Sorry, that was October 9th. On October 8th, Israel cut off all water from all of Gaza for a couple weeks. Then they returned water just to southern Gaza, did not let the water flow back into northern Gaza. And the Minister of Infrastructure and Energy said it, that the purpose of cutting off water to everywhere at first and only returning water to the south was to push everyone from the north to the south. That's just two examples. Time and time and time again, they keep saying it, that they're going to deny the flow of food, fuel, and medicine into Gaza. And then they do it, and now we're seeing the effects. And the effects now are we're starting to see children dying from malnutrition and dehydration, which indicates that there's probably a famine or that famine's around the corner. It's just sort of unfolding at a speed we've never seen before. We've never seen children pushed into malnutrition so quickly. This was all preventable. And I'll add one more fact. You know, in the current negotiations between Israel and Hamas, one of the negotiating points that Israel has put forward as something to offer to get concessions from Hamas is the provision and allowing for humanitarian aid to enter into Gaza. So that and that means that Israel is using humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip, to the point that that's actually what President Biden said today, that Israel should not use humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip. Sort of the president of the U.S. has reaffirmed what we put in our press release. Moreover, Israel is destroying the food system in Gaza. So it's not just denying humanitarian aid. It's not just shooting at civilians trying to get humanitarian aid. It's not just bombarding convoys of humanitarian trucks, even though those humanitarian trucks are coordinating with them. They're destroying the food system, meaning they've destroyed over 80% of the fishing fleets and fishing nets of small-scale fishers in Gaza. They're destroying agricultural land, fields, greenhouses, orchards. They're using white phosphorus, which poisons the land, so it makes it almost impossible to farm on that land in the near future.
Where are they using white phosphorus? Is this eastern Gaza in the agricultural margin?
Yes, they're using white phosphorus in eastern Gaza, and they're using white phosphorus in southern Lebanon.
I just want to pursue this because, you know, this idea that Israel is systematically denying food and humanitarian supplies to the Palestinians. I'm looking at a media flash from this entity in Canada that claims to advocate for honest reporting. They're really an agent of the Israeli government. What they say, it might as well be, you know, an IDF release. But here this entity says, since the beginning of the Hamas-instigated war in October, more than 14,000 trucks filled with humanitarian aid have entered Gaza, in addition to a growing number of airdrops. The amount of aid that is entering Gaza is also growing. On March 3rd, 277 trucks with humanitarian aid entered Gaza, the largest shipment in a single day. Israeli officials have repeatedly said there is no limit the amount of aid that can enter Gaza. So Israeli military and government sources and their media proxies are saying that Israel is moving heaven and earth to get aid and food into Gaza, but it's the aid distribution networks that are just really incompetent. Everybody is to blame for the situation except for Israel. And there, you know, thousands of trucks have been moving in. How do you comment on that?
So, you know, let's put this into context. Let's start even before the war. Before the war, Israel was imposing a blockade on Gaza it's about 17 years now. And the result of that blockade is they were denying the flow of a lot of food. And the result was that 50% of people in Gaza were food insecure, and 80% of people in Gaza depended on humanitarian aid. So for people to sort of hit the bare minimum of receiving enough food, and we're not even talking good quality and nutritious food, just like a bare minimum to get by, 500 trucks a day had to go into Gaza. This is before the war. Now the average, and this average comes from UN humanitarian organizations and other humanitarian organizations, the average ranges between 85 to 100 a day, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. That's not enough by any means. We know from humanitarian organizations that they're saying they're being held up at the border, that the process of entering, there's two crossing points. One is with Israel, Karim Shalom, and the other is Rafah with Egypt. The most goes through the Karim Shalom entry point through Israel. And we know from humanitarian organizations in the United Nations that the process is confusing, it's complicated, it's arbitrary. And they've indicated basically that they're being restricted. And all the UN agencies and all relief organizations and countries are saying, we are ready to provide as much aid as necessary to get in, and we're not being allowed in. What little aid is getting in, most of it is not going to the north. The north has been really blocked out from any aid in that effort, again, to sort of push everyone from the north to the south, which I might add is a war crime to do that to civilians. What aid does get through then, those convoys will coordinate with Israeli forces. And nevertheless, there's repeated reports from the UN that they are then bombarded. And then let's say the convoy gets through, the border, it's not bombarded, and then there's over 14 reported incidents of Israel shooting at civilians while they're seeking aid. The most recent flower massacre that you referred to from the press release was not the only one. That's one of a series. That one was just the worst one, in which Israeli soldiers shot at civilians, leading to the death of approximately 114 people and the injury of around 750. Sky News reported yesterday that the Israeli humanitarian agency, COGAT, I believe is the acronym, said that they're ready to provide humanitarian aid to people in Gaza. They haven't received the political green light yet from the appropriate ministries. And on top of that, when you see, as we've seen recently, the use of airdropping as a form of humanitarian relief, that always indicates that's the last measure. That's a measure of last resort. That's a desperate measure. It's incredibly expensive. It's incredibly inefficient. Humanitarian agencies all agree that it's very ineffective. That indicates that they're unable to get through otherwise. And now President Biden has announced he's going to build an ad hoc pier. It's sort of they're going to use the military to build a pier to bring in some aid through the sea. That's also not very effective. And we're seeing famine is imminent. I mean, we're seeing the effects as well. So if we take, you know, not even talking about how whether or not aid's getting through, we're seeing the effects. You add that all up, and that tells us that no, humanitarian aid is not entering sufficiently by any means. You know, what's interesting about the airdrops and this sort of maritime entry point, usually countries do that when they're trying to get humanitarian relief into enemy territory. I believe this is the first time the United States has done airdrops and has done this sort of maritime entry in a situation where it's in an ally's territory.
And where it's actually providing all the weapons and the bombs and the missiles.
Yeah, so it's American bombs and American aid dropping at the same time. The degree of vile absurdity, I mean, that's the only, I think, way I can describe it in that regard. So everyone's hungry. 2.3 million people were pushed into hunger at a speed we've never seen before. We've never seen a civilian population made to go hungry so completely and so quickly. That's what happened at the front, never, in modern history. We've never seen children pushed into malnutrition so quickly, never. This is in consultation, based on my own experience, but in consultation with starvation experts around the world and with UN humanitarian workers and leaders. This is the consensus amongst everyone who studies and works in this area. So measuring famine is very difficult in this instance because it's a war zone. So in terms of famine, in terms of understanding how it's measured in technical terms, there's three conditions that need to be met. First, at least 20% of the population is affected. In Gaza, we've seen that. The second condition, which is where we're at now, is that one out of three children are being acutely malnourished. This is also known as wasting. We're seeing that. The third condition is the hardest to measure. And this is that two people out of 10,000, for every 10,000 inhabitants, two people are dying every day because of starvation or malnutrition and disease, not because of bombing or bullets or that sort of thing. In talking with the people who measure famine, the consensus is that because we're they're in the middle of a war right now there, and it's hard to get in. People are being denied entry into Gaza. Reporters are being denied. Humanitarian workers are being denied entry. It's hard to determine that the degree of how many people are actually dying from malnutrition and disease and hunger versus bombs and bullets. Nevertheless, the fact that we're seeing now 15, I think, children, maybe the number today might even be up to 20, dying from malnutrition and dehydration. What that tells all of us, that tells us is that there probably already is a famine. And the speed, this is the part that's unique. The speed in which we're watching deterioration, the speed of the spread of hunger, the speed of death, the rate of death is really unprecedented. So it almost doesn't matter whether it's meets the formal criteria of famine or not. What we know is that the conditions are almost unimaginable.
And here you say in your press release of March 5th, as the risk of famine continues to rise, all children under five, there are 335,000 children under five, are at a high risk of severe malnutrition.
Exactly. And that's a conservative estimate at a risk of malnutrition, right? There we're being very tempered in the statistics. So what everyone agrees is what we can measure is actually an underestimate of the reality. Once we can have people enter into Gaza, more humanitarian workers and reporters, I have no doubt, and this is again in consultation with experts all over the world, we all have no doubt that the horror, the numbers, the degree of hunger, the degree of death from malnutrition will be higher than we're able to measure right now.
And there are reports of people eating animal feed and weeds, plants they pick from the ground.
They're feeding their children that. That's the part where it's brutal. They're foregoing meals, grown adults who have to choose who gets to eat in the family will prioritize the children, which everyone would do. And then all they have to offer their children is animal feed, which then actually leads to a lot of health issues, it does lead to malnutrition. It can lead to death if you're feeding them with whatever you have. There's no water. There's very little clean water in Gaza. People are having to drink dirty water. Knowing it's dirty water, they really have no choice. The part for me that it's almost hard to understand or process is this point we're at where children are dying from malnutrition and dehydration, and looking at those images and talking to colleagues who have talked to families in those situations. I mean, imagine being unable to feed your child and your child looking at you and there's nothing you can do, and then they die.
And you write here, at least 90% of children under 5 are affected by one or more infectious diseases, and 70% have diarrhea. What's the intersection between hunger, starvation, and infectious disease? And what can you tell me about the infectious disease situation in Gaza today?
When you don't get adequate food, and you're not getting sufficient nutrients, and you're low on energy, your immune system gets weaker. When your immune system gets weaker, you're going to be more vulnerable to infectious diseases. That's one. But two, the conditions that have led to hunger are often the same conditions that lead to higher rates of disease. The destruction of civil infrastructure, the lack of water, the lack of hospitals. Very few hospitals are left in Gaza. People living in close proximity, not living in their homes. They're living outside. They're living in tents, being forced to migrate. You combine all of that together, and that leads to exposure and vulnerability to infectious diseases.
Now, we're talking about hunger, starvation, famine, wasting, infectious disease, but there are going to be long-term generational impacts of this. Tens of thousands of children going hungry. What impact is this going to have on their long-term development prospects?
Yeah, this is what doctors would call stunting. There's a high risk of stunting for almost every child in Gaza. What that means is that when children between the ages of 0 and 5 don't receive adequate nutrients, that can lead to permanent physical and cognitive impairment in the future. So that would mean is that these kids in the future are going to require a significant amount of support to make sure that they can live a life with dignity. But then think of the trauma. 2.3 million people now have experienced profound trauma in ways I can't even pretend to know what that is. The number of children that have lost their entire family that are left alone, the psychological scars of people that manage to survive are at a scale and to a degree. I mean, it's as if Israel is trying to dam all the children in Gaza.
Little snakes, Ayala Shaked called them.
Yeah, children of the night, snakes. I mean, the dehumanizing language was from the first day. You know, I've been very focused in our conversation on what's happening on the ground. But if we're going to get into the dehumanizing language and the racism and the callousness, that was from the beginning. This is why we raised the alarm of genocide within weeks of this particular war, was the blatant dehumanization expressed by Israeli politicians and decision makers against the Palestinian people. So when you don't imagine a people as human or as civilians, then you employ all of these policies and techniques that we're witnessing in Gaza.
Michael Fakhry is a professor at the University of Oregon School of Law and special UN rapporteur on the right to food. Listen to our complete conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Genocide, the so-called crime of crimes, a crime against humanity under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, a group of Canadian lawyers and legal scholars have submitted a letter to the Canadian government demanding that it take all actions within its power to prevent the commission of genocide in Gaza, something they say the Trudeau government is not doing at the moment. Specifically, the group is calling on Ottawa to halt arms sales to Israel and Canada's importation of Israeli arms and weapon systems. It also wants Ottawa to suspend military cooperation with Israel, to ban the importation of products produced in Jewish settlements in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, to impose sanctions on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his cabinet ministers and top military chiefs, to withdraw Canada's ambassador, to prosecute individuals and groups recruiting Canadians to serve in the Israeli military, and to prohibit Canadian enlistment in the IDF. That's just part of their list of demands on behalf of three Palestinian Canadians who've lost family members in Gaza. One of them has lost 74 members of his extended family in the course of Israel's bombing campaign, soon to enter its seventh month. I spoke about the demand for action letter with two of its authors. Dimitri Lascaris is a private attorney, journalist, and activist. Faisal Baba is an attorney with the Legal Center for Palestine. I want to ask you, this is a demand for action. What is a demand for action?
The essence of the demand is that the Genocide Convention, to which Canada is a party, contains an obligation embodied in Article 1, that the parties prevent and punish genocide. And we say with confidence that the obligation on the part of all parties, including Canada, to prevent genocide has been triggered for a variety of reasons, but simply by virtue of the fact that the International Court of Justice has determined by an overwhelming margin that it is plausible that Israel is committing genocide. You don't have to have a final adjudication of genocide happening in order for the Article 1 obligation to be triggered. So it's been triggered. And based on everything that we have seen and heard from the Canadian government has done effectively nothing at all of any significance to comply with its obligations. And in addition, we say that the Canadian government is violating certain of our clients' rights under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom, including the right to security of the person and the right to equality.
Yeah, it's worth just emphasizing that the duty to prevent genocide does not require that there be a proven genocide happening. I mean, it wouldn't be logical. I mean, you can't prevent a genocide that is already happening. You can prevent it from continuing. But the notion that the Canadian government needs to do something where there is a plausible risk of genocide, we now have a finding of the International Court of Justice that's found at least the possibility that a genocide may be occurring or may occur, which I think is an understatement, a severe understatement. But even taking that most modest finding, it's clear that Canada's obligation under the Genocide Convention has been triggered. And the fact that it has done nothing really gives it no basis on which to assert that it has met its legal obligations.
Can you tell me about the three clients, the three folks, Palestinian Canadians, who you've written this demand letter to the Canadian government on behalf of?
We have three clients who are Canadian citizens, who all of whom were born in Gaza and came to Canada at some point and became citizens. All of them have lost family members in Gaza. all of them have family members alive in Gaza who they wish to be reunited with. And all of them assert that they have been effectively abandoned by their government, left to figure this out entirely on their own. I don't know if we need to go into the details of each of the three individuals. Their names are Hani El-Betigni, Tamer Jarada, and Ra'ed Sharif. They are people that we identified from our connections in the Palestinian Canadian community and from raising awareness about these issues. They kind of appeared. We came to know of them. They're not connected to one another, and they're not really connected to any of us. But they found us in their quest for access to justice, in their quest for support and help to pressure the Canadian government to do something, anything. But they each have harrowing tales of family suffering and of the need for family unification.
Hani El-Betigni lost 74 members of extended family as a consequence of the bombardment. Tamer Jarada, his mother, father, two sisters, two nephews, an uncle, and his wife, three cousins and spouses and children, and two of those cousins have all been killed. And Ra'ed Sharif has suffered similar losses.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Sharif still has a number of surviving siblings and their families. The last we spoke, he had eight surviving siblings and their families who he wishes to reunite with. And, you know, every day is a risk that they will no longer be alive to be brought out and saved.
And Dimitri Lascaris, I mean, in terms of in the context of genocide, alleged genocide, which the International Court of Justice says is plausible, as did a U.S. District Court in California, like a day after the ICJ ruling, said couldn't rule on the lawsuit that had been brought against Joe Biden and Austin and Anthony Blinken because it was outside the court's jurisdiction. But the U.S. District Court, Northern California, said that charges of genocide are plausible. And here we have a situation where how many extended families in Gaza, consisting of anywhere from 7 or 8 or 9 to like 25 or 30 extended family members wiped out, like entire families wiped out. I think there's several dozen examples of families in Gaza, entire extended families wiped out. And this is the experience of certainly one of your clients. Can you talk about this, Dimitri?
Well, you know, when we spoke, you know, to Mr. Jarada, who didn't have the greatest losses amongst the devastating losses that our three clients have endured, I remember very distinctly how personally that affected me, because in the course of 4 years, I lost my mother and my father and my eldest sister. And I remember the impact that that had upon me. I had the opportunity, first of all, my mother and father, you know, at that stage of their lives, they were retired and they had lived long lives. And I had the opportunity to recover from each one because it didn't happen all at once. But, you know, Mr. Jarada, he lost all at once, you know, in the space of days or weeks at most, his parents, two siblings, and number of cousins and uncles and aunts. And I just, when I heard him recount this, which he did in a calm voice, I thought to myself, I would be comatose if I had had to endure such a thing. And then we have a client, as you mentioned, who lost 74 family members. It's unimaginable that somebody could survive such a loss emotionally. And somehow we demand of our brothers and sisters in Gaza that they endure these horrors. And I think that the least we can do as a country is everything within our power to assist them and to stop the mass slaughter of their family members. And what are we doing? Our government is doing nothing. In fact, it's doing worse than nothing. It's actually sending military equipment to Israel, and it suspended funding to the United Nations Relief Works Agency on the very day that the International Court of Justice adjudged it to be plausible that Israel was committing genocide.
And it's just now restored. Canada has restored UNRWA funding.
Well, it appears that that's what intention its intention is going to be, but I'll believe it when the check is in the mail.